Hello and welcome to FinTech Impact. I'm your host, Jason Pereira. Today's show, I have Emmanuel Daniel, founder of Tab Global, an international research and publishing company that focuses on commentary on banking and transformation. And I brought him on the show today to talk about his book, The Great Transition. It is a book that basically addresses how banks are transforming into the newer modern digital age and the evolution of open banking and what that means for everybody. And with that, here's my interview with Emmanuel. Emmanuel, thanks for taking the time today.
Thanks, Jason. Great to be on your program.
Pleasure. So tell us, Emmanuel Daniel, about your book, The Great Transition.
I completed the book in 2022. And essentially, when I talk about the great transition in banking, and in fact, after I had published it and went around and made presentations and so on, I realized that the idea of a transition or the transformation of the banking industry means very different things to different people. There are those in the industry who, to whom transition or transformation is just a matter of moving from ATM to internet banking or from internet banking to social media or something like that. It's incremental. The transition that I speak about in my book is fundamental, and it takes us to a whole new dimension. In order to explain that transformation in the simplest possible manner, I start the book with just asking the reader to think about how the ICE industry transformed being something that you saw out of the lakes, Boston or whatever the northern cities are, put it on ICE-drawn carriages and take it into the city to what ICE is today, which is you produce it when you want it and how you want it. Now, by using that analogy, I'm saying that, in fact, the title of my book is The Great Transition, The Personalization of Finance is Here. So what I'm saying is that we are now arrived at where the entire intermediary function of financial institutions is under threat. And that's because the technologies today exist for individuals to transact with each other. And the technologies also are coming into shape where businesses like payments can look very different when it's tokenized and it's personalized. And so the transformation I'm talking about is not just from core banking to cloud, and from cloud to AI and stuff like that, which is pretty much what's happening in the industry. What I'm asking the industry to do is to think about the general direction of where the industry is going, how the first principles of finance are being rewritten. And it's interesting that about a year into having published the book, I begin to be able to see a congruence or coming together between decentralized finance and traditional banking. And I think that that's a much more concrete description of the transformation that I discussed in the book. And so the first principles in the book, they all remain up to today. And in fact, they're being validated as we see the transformations coming on stream. In fact, like what's happening today, central banks in several countries are preparing their respective domestic banks to digitize and to tokenize their deposit business, something that was unbelievable just a few years ago. And so we are already arriving at the frontiers of what finance will look like. Now, all of that will have an impact on how traditional banks will need to be run and the matrix by which they will be measured for performance, for infrastructure, and how they relate to their customers. For the most part, the book deals with technical issues that bankers need to be worried about, but I've endeavored to deliver it in the simplest possible way and looking at allegories and parallels from other industries and how that's applied to the future of finance.
Okay. So a lot to unpack, but we'll get to a couple of points. We'll get to a couple of key points. So tell me about your background first, and then tell me about what inspired you to write the book.
I graduated as a lawyer and then spent 10 years trying to figure out what exactly would catch my passion. And then I started something called the Asian Banker out of Singapore and used that as a platform to meet just as many chairmen and CEOs of banks, ministers of finance. And so I spent, and this was in 1996. So I've now been 26, 28 years of going around the world, literally, meeting people in leadership positions in the banking industry. So the business itself has broadened out. We do a lot of consulting, research. We run training programs. We run study tours, a whole range of stuff. And a lot around traditional banking, And then somewhere in the 2000s, I started to think about what the future of the industry will look like. So the book is, in a way, a culmination of my own professional development and challenging myself to look at the industry from the outside in. And especially when you generate revenue from traditional banks, sit alongside them and talk about the things that they're working on, it's very easy to be caught up with incumbency and to see the industry from the inside out and think that you'll be able to harness the changes and tame it for the industry as it is. In a way, it's like what's happening to the EV car industry, how the incumbents, the Volkswagen and the Ford, thought that they could curate the transformation into at their own time, in their own pace, in their own way. But now we find that an entire industry has evolved and is upon them. And there are new players that didn't exist just 2 years ago, which are now dominating the marketplace. That is the kind of transformation that I'm thinking about in finance. And there's a whole lot of things happening, and we do need to structure this conversation so that we catch a few of those transformational issues that banks need to face up to. And one of the things that is very much on my mind right now is how the rules of decentralized finance are beginning to dictate how traditional banks should be run. So when we think about a traditional bank, we're thinking about batch processing, core banking systems that sit on mainframes, evolution times that are 6 months to 2 to 4 years for product development and all of that. And then when you look at the characteristics of the crypto industry or the decentralized finance industry, you're talking 24/7, complete liquidity, availability of liquidity at all times, totally unleveraged asset base and applications being developed on them by thousands of users around the world. We've now come to a point where all of these issues that traditional bankers need to deal with and their current existing infrastructure doesn't allow them to. And so we need to think about a transition that's involved in making to embed in embodying the new rules of finance that are coming on stream.
Okay. So basically you touched upon a number of things. All right. So let's go back and describe what this transition is. If you were to give it in like the core bullet points. What are the core bullet points of what this transition means?
The first core bullet point really is that the end user of finance is being empowered. So if you take crypto, the beauty of crypto is not that Bitcoin can go up to $60,000. The beauty of crypto is anyone can design a crypto and launch it and issue it and put it out there for anyone to accept. Now, the fact of whether or not a crypto launch will be successful is dependent on who you are, whether your friends trust you, and what sort of valuation that they would give after you. And in the early days, of course, it also meant that a number of rogue players can go out there, and that's what we saw with Sam Bankman-Fried, for example. He puts out a crypto, he gives it a valuation of $187 or something like that, and the market actually believes him. So we are in the early days of the individual, the end user of finance, being able to decide how he wants to interact with everybody around him. And what that means is that the whole business of intermediation has to be re-engineered, and what the roles that banks play have to be re-engineered. And there are similar transitions taking place. So when we think about peer-to-peer platforms, for example, the whole idea is to match individuals with each other, whether it's in investing or lending, without an intermediary and without the balance sheet. And all of that had its early phases. But now with AI and a lot more data being processed, it's going to take a life of its own. So the first bullet point really is that the end user of finance is being empowered in a way that was never thought possible before. And then related to that comes all of the other bullet points, and that is how should the financial institution be configured? And right now, financial institutions see themselves as purveyors of products that they try and sell to the end user, financial products. And all of these products are intermediary products, funds, deposits. You give it to us, we look after it for you, we add value and we return it to you with a profit. But a lot of that now is able to be managed by the individual. As that evolves, the whole idea of product itself has to be reconfigured, rethought through. So I make a bold statement, and that is The conversation is the product. And I've said this many times in recent months, and I have bankers scratching their heads and saying, what do you mean by the conversation is the product? So what I'm saying to bankers is that you think that your fund or your deposit product or your structured deposit is the product. But with so much data being available on your customer, watching your customers talk to other customers and taking stock of the conversations that go on between people in everyday life, that's where you will find your product. And very often, and increasingly, banks now need to design products that meet the needs of individuals at the point of those needs. And of course, you have entire new ecosystems like the metaverse, where the whole new generation that interacts almost entirely within that universe of digital assets and so on with each other. So the banking industry needs to be in there, but it cannot be in there by trying to fob off yet another product to the industry or to the end user, because the end users are all networked with each other already. So that would be the second bullet point, that the conversation is the product. The third bullet point, at this point in the conversation, because I'm actually drawing from conversations I've been having in recent times, is that fintech players and anyone involved in innovation in finance has to challenge the regulator in order to be able to do what's right. What regulators are trying to do today is really to harness all the innovations that are taking place and try to keep it within the institutions that they understand. So a lot of the regulations that seems to be anti-innovation or trying to rein in the disruptors and trying to bring that back into traditional banks, that's a temporary measure. With a lot more processing power and a lot more technology, the industry will just keep evolving despite regulation and despite the desire of traditional banks to want to dominate them. So for digital assets, for example, it's interesting that I see that both the BIS, the Bank for International Settlement, as well as its members, the central banks in several countries, are now encouraging their banks to tokenize their deposit business, to put in experiments and pilots to try and get that off the ground. But the unintended consequence of that is that there are already alternatives in the marketplace. Stable coins are alternatives in the marketplace. In fact, what the BIS is trying to get banks to do is essentially a stable coin by another name. And there are other players, exchanges, cold wallets that are already available out there. The fact that central banks and regulators are trying to only harness technology to be run by the banks as we know them to be, I don't think that's going to hold very, very well for very long. So that will be the third bullet point, and that is that innovation cannot be structured and curated by regulators for too long. And there are other bullet points that I can go on to, but I think that these are topmost in my mind because of what's going on around the world today.
All right, so if I'm going to sum it up, I'm going to say that, frankly, a lot of what you're saying is basically largely driven by crypto as a concept. Whether, as for the execution of it, we can debate exactly where that's happening or how it's going to happen. We can talk about that in a moment. But really, it's three real themes are overlapping. One is the creation of the option for peer-to-peer finance, effectively, in a secure manner. Two is the further move towards, I'd say, the further commoditization of products in general. And now the alternative, the need to service consumers by actually listening to consumers is actually greater, and they cannot be as generic. So you have the customization of finance trend. And then the last one is the regulatory challenges and wrapping their head around all this, which has been a problem around the world. But in fairness, they exist for a reason. They exist to protect consumers. You can argue that there's regulatory capture that protects incumbents. But at the end of the day, if things go wrong, the pitchforks come out and they go to their house, to the regular houses, not to the crypto houses. So that's the reality. Everybody loves the idea until people lose money, and then they wish the regulators had a time machine. So it's a big challenge. Okay.
Very good. Actually, I want to add one more point. All your points are valid. The fourth bullet point really would be that the banking industry totally missed out the API revolution, in my view. Today, banks have a different tone in the way in which they work with their API partners. When you look at what APIs were meant to be, if you look at the software companies, the whole idea is that any of their end users can interact with them and build their own APIs at the user end. Whereas in the early days of the API revolution with banking, banks tended to treat APIs almost like a patch solution vendor, I call them, meaning that you interact with us in order to be able to help us solve some of our initial problems. And then they realized that the customer wants greater control over how they interact with the banks to build their own interfaces and so on. And then in payments especially, that's become an important part of being a successful payment player. That is, to what extent you allow your end user to design your own interfaces. So banks are beginning to work with their API players better. But a lot is happening on that front, which has gone ahead of the banking industry.
So we're going to get to one of the most painful topics I ever talk about, just because I live in Canada and you want to talk about API interfaces and banks playing nice with other companies. That is jurisdictionally dependent, quite honestly. And in large part, I always say there's different models around the world, as we talked about. There's, I'd say, the free market-led model, which is largely out of the US, where people figure out how to do it and there's enough competition to incentivize people to play nice. There's the opposite of the spectrum, which is the European model of basically regulating it in and forcing banks and financial institutions to do it. And then they play some funny games where they try to do the bare minimum and make it difficult. And then there's everything in between. I think, what do you think the most, you know, in your mind, where have you seen the most effective implementation of open banking in the world? And what kind of helped create that situation?
Oh, now that is a curveball for me, because I do follow everything that's been happening around the world. By the way, the OCC in the US just issued a statement saying, telling the banks that your relationship with your IT vendors dependent on you. We hold you personally accountable, or as a corporation, you're accountable for anything that goes wrong in your relationship with your third parties. Now, that's a backhanded way of saying that be careful of your API relationships. Don't make it too open.
But in fairness, they should be. Like you're, if you're relinquishing data to a third party, you bear liability, as you should. And I think when the SEC came out with the regulation on all, everyone needs to be SOC 2 compliant for vendors within a certain amount of time, I'm sitting there going, like, how did this take so long? I will say the American system, I feel that the privacy laws are not as stringent. And because of that, there's just not as much caution taken. And they're used to the surveillance economy, to borrow a term from a book, where they're used to giving out personal information for free stuff. So I think it's not surprising that this has gone a little too far and people have had to be reminded, you're responsible for stewardship of that. You're liable for that.
It depends on what exactly these IT vendors are doing for the bank. Now, that's not open banking. That's vendor relationship. And, yes. And in vendor relationship, absolutely. You know, you outsource your infrastructure to the cloud or to a cloud provider and so on. You are responsible for that relationship and you are responsible to your customers. And no, that caution is fair. But when that caution is applied to a whole different business model, which is end users deciding how they want to interact with you, the focus is really that you look after your own and your own infrastructure, but you do need an infrastructure that is able to go out there and allow people to do their own thing. Gaming has that same infrastructure. Nobody issues a warning to the gaming companies that your API players, you're responsible for whatever your API players do, because they know that if there's a breach in the system, the entire gaming business goes out of the window. It's really where it's being applied to and what the understanding of API. If the understanding is an API is a patch solution vendor to my problems, then yes, you do need to safeguard your own data and stuff like that. Open banking, which jurisdictions are the furthest down the road? I thought for a while that Australia was really very, very liberal. In a way, Australia did allow the revolution in, I forget the name now, but I just lost my train of thought. But they allowed the can we edit this?
Yeah, we'll let it go back. We'll go back to Australia allowed and we'll fix that.
I mean, one second. Australia allowed, you call them the payment companies. It's just my strength. Before you continue, Australia allowed, not peer-to-peer payment, the word peer-to-peer is in my head a lot. Australia allowed the credit card processing companies and buy now, pay later. Okay, that's what
BNPL. Okay, so we're going to go back to Australia allowed and we're going to start there. Okay, go ahead. So Australia, so take it up from Australia allowed.
So like Australia allowed buy now, pay later, for example, and that opened a floodgates to new buy now, pay later companies, all, you know, proposing that they were going to revolutionize finance. At the back end, it turned out to be the same credit card processing business where at the point of sale, you give the option to the buyer to pay in installments or and vary their payment processes and so on. So as a technology, it worked. The focus was a lot on the interfaces and the user. But at the end of the day, it just went back to the idea that it is a function of the balance sheet. And a couple of them in Australia got into serious trouble because they were scrapping the bottom of the barrel to look for high-risk customers. And therefore, they needed to put a lot more capital in the business and the cost of acquiring was much higher than they thought and so on. And even the ones in Scandinavia. So the ones that went further down the road with open banking, thinking that it was an interface problem, realized then at the end of the day that it was still a balance sheet business problem, which is who are your customers and how high risk are they and what do you have on your balance sheet to be able to onboard high risk customers and so on. So I think that I would take Australia as a good example. There's a lot of initiatives. The South African regulators are a lot more liberal, except that they don't have much happening on the technology front. So the South African regulators are very interested in using open banking to secure more unbanked customers. The big problem there is KYC, which is how do you implement a stringent KYC system that can onboard otherwise undocumented end users who didn't exist in the banking system before. So that's where they are with open banking. And of course, that the UK has done a rethink about where open banking is today and so on. And there are, by the way, there are jurisdictions like Singapore which eschewed open banking. They're not even interested in that. And actually, I think about Singapore when I think about a jurisdiction which tries to curate the entire innovations taking place in finance back to the traditional banks. And that's what they tried to do for a long time. They still have that kind of a mindset. You won't hear a Singapore regulator say anything about open banking just for now.
Excellent. All right, so let's go back to the traditional incumbents. So what does this mean in terms of actionable items for traditional banks? What do they need to be thinking about? What do they need to be doing?
One of the things I do is I run workshops for banks thinking about innovation and how they want to strategize their own roadmap to what they need to build. And then I find that banks in very different phases of their own innovations, and also it depends on the marketplace. If it's a marketplace where there's a large percentage of unbanked customers, then innovation just simply means creating a digital bank and making your KYCs work in such a way as to onboard as many customers as possible. So that alone can take a bank or a country 3 to 5 years before they're ready to take on to the next level. And then in much more mature markets, it's really to broaden out the asset base of your customer from basic deposits to digital assets and alternative assets, a lot of them digital that are coming on stream right now. And so it's more of a wealth management type problem that they're trying to deal with. And how do you deal with wealth management customers who are much more self-directed in terms of their asset management and their wealth management? So I seem to be dealing with very different customer bases. And there is one client, one bank that is quite small in a country and not the smallest, but not the largest either. And they have decided to go on looking at small business banking. And there, a lot of the work has to be on supply chains, working out how the supply chains flow between manufacturers and distributors in the country for specific businesses and how they can dominate that industry because the big players haven't figured it out or there's a need that needs to be met. But in every of these instances, I start by telling them that just remember this, the end user has greater options today, and the number of options he has is growing. You cannot have a business model that tries to dominate the relationship or tries to be an intermediary for being an intermediary's sake. There has to be another value that you're providing. So when I say things like the conversation is the product, I'm saying to them, pay attention to areas that you're not making money in today. Things like creating platforms where your end users are talking with each other or giving you feedback, which gives them, give you a broader perspective of what they're thinking. And the more you collect that data, the more relevant you can become to them. And don't think about the products for product's sake, or even configure your business to be successful on a product basis. So these are some of the conversations that I am having with banks that I run workshops with and stuff like that. Now, that's for today. And among the digital banks, I think that around the world, what I'm seeing is that the countries that have opened licenses for digital banks, in places like Hong Kong, for example, which is now 3 years down the road with 8 new digital banks, none of them even making a scratch or a dent on the deposit base of the incumbent large banks in the country. Oh. And then I think that they need to be rethinking what the future will be. And so some of the ideas that I have in my book are relevant to digital banks if they're going to be game changers going into the future.
Excellent. All right, so we're going to wrap it up with three questions. And on a positive note, Mickey, I think I asked everyone. I'm going to modify some of them a little bit because you're not a fintech founder. So if you had one wish for something to change in industry as a whole, what would it be?
Arrogance.
Oh, no kidding.
If there was one wish, it's one thing that I wish that will change in the industry as a whole is there's a sense of understanding, thinking where the future will be. I'm not sure if that's the answer that you're looking for. But in terms of technology, the things that are changing, data analytics and all of that is changing. But I think that presumptuousness is, I think, the one biggest disease in the finance industry. So that's the first thing that came to my mind.
Awesome. All right. Second question is basically, what in your career, what's been the biggest challenge in getting to where you are today?
The biggest challenge to being where we are today, where I am today, has been in what was the biggest challenge? The biggest challenge has been and I think that a lot of the fintech players will identify with this, which is that understanding what people are willing to pay for, whether it's a bank or a customer. A lot of what I've been talking about are conceptually very good, except that what exactly are customers willing to pay for? And getting that right is very important. And I think that a lot of your fintech listeners would subscribe to that.
Okay. The last question I have for you is, what excites you about what it is you're working on and keeps you getting out of bed every morning to keep on fighting the good fight?
The future, in fact, that's what I've morphed into. I see myself as a futurist. And I started with finance, banking, which is the industry I come from. But you'll also find in my book, I talk a little bit about geopolitics and how nation states do things in moments of distress and crisis, and that becomes the defining character of the next phase. So I'm looking for inflection points in the industry or in society as a whole. So if you ask me what makes me wake up in the middle of the night and think of something a lot more deeper, inflection points. For example, in the payments industry, will the US dollar lose its dominance as a global reserve currency? When will the Chinese renminbi ever take off and stuff like that? A lot, and also like cryptocurrencies, how is the SEC regulating digital assets, or how do they define crypto? Stuff like that. Now, those are prosaic to me. What I look for in all of this are inflection points. And inflection points in finance, and it has been proved for the last 300 years, that they always happen in points of crisis. The Bank of England was formed to fund a war. And the Federal Reserve Bank in the US was finally created in 1917 or something, in 1911, after 1907 crisis. The way in which the industry moves and society as a whole moves, we look for those inflection points. And there are inflection points coming on stream. So in the last chapter of my book, for example, I talk about the next banking crisis. And I try to draw a scenario of what it will look like. And I think that it will be a lot more digital, a lot more ephemeral. It will be very difficult to define what an asset is. stuff like that. And then you look for the inflection points where decisions are made and the industry then goes on to a next level. Another one is, of course, the 1970 fallout of the gold standard, which was a decision made to be temporal. But look at where we are today. You know, we now have floated currencies worldwide and central banks around the world issuing fiat currency no longer based on any tangible asset. So we're looking for the next inflection point, which will be precipitated by a crisis.
Okay, excellent. Manuel, thank you so much for your time. Very much appreciated.
Thanks, Jason. Thank you very much.
So that was my interview with Emmanuel Daniel. I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, if you enjoyed that podcast, please review on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, or get your podcast. Until next time, take care.
This podcast was brought to you by Woodgate Financial, an award-winning financial planning firm catering to high net worth individuals and their families. To learn more, go to woodgate.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, or find more episodes at jasonpereira.ca.